Welcome to the Amazon Legends Podcast, where we have real stories about making it big on Amazon. Our guests are CEOs of large companies and entrepreneurs who became powerful sellers, also experts specializing in helping sellers, and both former and current Amazon employees who will give us an insight from behind the scenes. Here's your host, Nick Urison.
Welcome to another episode of Amazon Legends. My next guest today spent over a decade in e-commerce working for BigCommerce. And for those of you who have their websites with BigCommerce will know the company. It's one of the big companies. And then he started a brand on Amazon and sold it to an aggregator, even though they got kicked off. It was good enough for an aggregator to buy. So today he's the co-founder of Living Fit that specializes in fitness with their equipment and digital fitness programs. When he's not working, he likes learning languages in his free time. Currently, he's working on French and Chinese. I wonder how long he's going to take learning Chinese. Well, he can tell us that himself. So with that, everybody, meet my guest, Jay Perkins. Welcome to the show, Jay.
Hey, Nick. Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's always a pleasure to have Amazon sellers who have been through the zinger and sold it and come back and doing it again. So it's always good to speak with people with experience. So this is your first year. And when you and I discussed your operation on Amazon, I heard you mention that even though it's your first year, you're registering growth month over month. So tell us, how are you achieving that?
That's correct. It takes several key actions and in the right order.
So give us the first, let's start with the most important. So what is the most important action and when do you take that action?
It'd be hard for me to say an important one, the most important, but I would say, obviously, you got to have products that people want to buy and need. So at some level, it does start with the overall business strategy of what will you be selling? What's the need you're trying to solve? And what is the value proposition you can provide to a customer of why they should buy from you and not someone else?
So finding the right product. That's what. Okay. So how do you give us some of the parameters that you ever, so you started a brand before and then you sold it to an aggregator. So, and then now you're building Living Fit. Is that because you've done research or is that because, you know, you had some passion for the space?
Yeah, it's a great question. With Living Fit, it's more based on experience. My first business was in the fitness space. It was just much more niche product. We focused on one specific fitness tool. So obviously being in that space, I can understand and know a little bit more about the fitness space in general. My experience is based on what I saw work well in that business. And now I feel like I have a pretty good blueprint in my head of how that would work for really any set of businesses, whether that would be home and garden or anything else. It just happens to be being applied to another fitness business right now.
Okay. So based on your own experience, you decided this will be something. So share with us some of the research you did before starting this.
Yeah. You know, it's in a lot of ways very basic and heuristic, almost embarrassingly so. You know, one would be like looking at Google search trends, for example, right? So the business that I currently run was started as kind of a sub-brand or sister brand of the original business as we look to diversify our product line. As I mentioned, we were focusing on one specific item. And so we wanted to think of different ways that we could make sure that the business could continue to grow if something was to happen to the main product line. So it's things like, you know, looking at hashtags on Instagram, looking at Google search trends, looking at search trends on Amazon, for example, in the keyword analytics to see what people are searching the most for. And that's now mainly how I try to target new products to look at.
When you are doing your search, Are you looking at the search volume available for the product?
Yeah, that's correct. If you're referring to Amazon specifically, yeah. So we'll look at what that search volume is.
Okay. So this is before you decide what product you're going to sell. In your research, you're trying to figure out basically the demand, how much demand there is.
Yeah, that's correct. And then, you know, there's other things that will now go into it. Given that I've been in the industry a little bit of time, you know, I will have decent relationships with review sites. And so, you know, I might try to find out what types of products are they looking to review or do they need space for on their sites so that I can get some links to those Amazon pages almost right away.
So about the search volume, what would make a good search volume for the product to say, okay, this has potential?
Yeah, that's a great question. In a lot of ways, I wish I had, you know, a more firm answer for you on what that would be. My decision-making is rooted a lot in what my original business was, you know, and when we sold that business, you know, we had number one organic rankings on the internet for that. And we were doing about $5.5 million a year in revenue. And so I tend to look at just that as the baseline and say to myself, if there's anything above this, I know I can generate a meaningful amount of revenue off of it. Now I need to start looking into the margins and go through some of the other checklists like review websites and what the competition is, the pricing, all that kind of stuff.
Okay. All right. So because usually when you are building your content, especially with titles and bullets and things like that, you have to do your keyword research. And when you're doing that research, you are trying to pick up keywords that have a search volume of, usually when I work with my clients, we look for anything between 1,000 to 10,000 or 15,000 monthly searches.
Yeah, I would definitely want to be closer in that 10 to 15,000 search volume.
Yeah.
So that's a helpful gauge in that that's about the previous product that I had. That's about close to what that was. And so if I see anything in that range or higher, you know, that lets me know that that's something that I'm going to be interested in doing. I can start thinking about what the content strategy would be for that item.
Yeah. So this brings me to something I always say. I always tell my clients, don't look at Amazon as the marketplace of products. Amazon is a marketplace of keywords. All you do is you marry the product with the keyword. So what I'm hearing from you is that's exactly what you did. You just simply searched, found the keywords, and then built a whole content strategy around those keywords for you to simply dominate that space, right?
Yeah, that's really correct. You know, in a lot of ways, I do think Amazon can be formulaic in that way, that if you have a good strategy in how to identify products and how to identify keywords and create good content around it, then it's a matter of, you know, solving supply chains and margins and that type of thing. But over time, you're going to do all right if you follow that strategy, I believe.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's all, you know, as they say, the fish stinks from the top down. So you know, if you have the right strategy, it all works out in the end. And if you don't, then obviously it falls apart. And if you have no strategy, by default, you have a strategy, which is nothing. So it doesn't go anywhere.
That's exactly right. And that's kind of what I mean when I say I wish it was a little bit more formulaic and how I do it. It's just because the experience I have and knowing what works, I just know that if I see this volume and I can identify the margins are there, it's going to work out over time at this point.
Yeah. Okay. So the first key action is identifying the product based on the demand where you do your research into different search terms. So what's the second key action?
If we're assuming at this point that all of the products are actually set up and you have descriptions and keywords, is that correct?
Well, you're building the business, you identify the product, and then you devise your content strategy. They will come next, but right. You have an idea which direction you're going to move. So what happens next?
Yeah, so next is you definitely need to set up some form of a marketing budget, right? And that's one of the things that I really learned early on in business and probably took for granted. You know, in my first business, we kind of thought we're going to have high quality product. We're going to have really good messaging and free shipping. Who's not going to buy from us, you know? But then there's so much more that goes into building a brand and building that critical mass of customers and word of mouth. So that's why I think the actual marketing and having a budget for marketing spend is next. Now, obviously, that's assuming you don't have a way that you're going viral or have some high powered influencers behind you that are going to drive a lot of sales right away. But I would say for the majority of businesses, it's going to be then establishing that marketing spend and constantly refining that.
So this is always a question that's very hard to answer because there is no history. Like usually if you have history, you have an idea how much you spend on things and what they do for you. But when you're starting from scratch, setting a marketing budget, can you walk us through how you came to determining how much you should allocate?
I think it's going to be different for every business, obviously, right? I mean, whether you're bootstrapping from the beginning or you've got, you know, some investors and some market research that you can look at what your expected ROI on marketing should be. So there's not a one size fit all fits all. I would say I would plan that you're going to spend more than you think you're going to plan that you think you're going to. I've almost always found that to be true, that it's just going to take more time and more marketing than you think. So honestly, it comes down to budget, also your personal financial situation. You know, in the first business, we were making our livings off that business. Like that's how we were putting food on our table, right? Fortunately, now that we've had an exit, we're in this situation where we don't necessarily have to rely on that income right away and can invest more. So I think it's just a decision that you have to make on, you know, where you're at in life and what your business structure is.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yes. At the same time, you know, one of my favorite sayings, you never want to get half pregnant, right? So you are launching a product. You've launched it now. Sure. And first of all, you want to leverage the honeymoon period.
Right.
In addition, you cannot just do little by little. You have to go because time is now ticking. Amazon is ranking you with everything you do. So there is really a minimum amount that you have to be in for. Otherwise, you're just wasting, you know, the small amount. It becomes drip, drip, drip. You just spend a little bit without getting enough. So the biggest question that people don't really bring into the whole equation of things is, when you spend money in marketing, this is not a cost where, like, you know, rent or payroll or anything like that. This is money that is being spent to bring revenue. So what is an unknown is, how much can I expect to generate in revenue if I spend X number of dollars? So that question, of course, it varies, but launching a brand new listing, a new brand. Can you share with us what your experience was as you spent your marketing dollars? What were you seeing as revenues you could generate in relation to the dollars you spent?
Yeah. And obviously with Amazon, there's all different types of campaigns that, you know, you can or should be running, right, based on recommendations. And so even though I had a pretty good amount of experience over the last decade, you know, in e-commerce and some selling on Amazon, this first year was my first time really running the marketing on our own and doing it myself. And so, you know, we found that early on, like we were fortunate to be getting about a 6 to 8 return on ad spend on some of our best sellers, right? And then obviously you have to manage your supply chain too, right? Because you got to be getting it as it comes out. So, you know, we were spending probably about just $2,000 a month for the first couple of months of the year while we were getting that tested and figuring out what keywords work and what works. You know, over the last 90 days into Christmas, we've ramped that up to about $1,000 or $2,000 a day is what we're spending right now in the advertising. Now, again, I mentioned there's different types of ads, you know, so not all of them have that 6 to 8 ROI anymore. You know, some of them are higher up the funnel, so to speak. And so those are getting, you know, a 2 or 1.5, 2.5, something like that. But they're right. Part of the overall needs for building awareness about a new brand and making sure that it's sticky in people's minds.
Okay. So $2,000 a month at the beginning when you launched, that's yes. What you said. So in that first month, how much did you generate in revenue altogether?
Probably close to 30,000.
Really?
Yeah.
That's pretty good. It's 15 times your...
Well, I wouldn't... Okay, sorry. If the question is how much was the total revenue, that I'm giving you the total revenue.
So the first month you spent the 2,000, how much revenue did you generate?
Yeah, it was probably 6 to 8, I think, would be attributed to that.
Still pretty good.
Yeah, we were fortunate that, you know, with dumbbells specifically, for example, that's just such a large market on Amazon. I think that, again, this was my first time even setting up ads and trying to kind of learn on the go that there's just so many people searching for it that you can get a better ROI. Some other items like resistance bands or slam balls are a lot more competitive, and I've never really felt super happy about what we can get on that. You know, we're usually in the 2 range, but dumbbells, you know, like I said, I got it as high as 6 to 8 return on ad spend, you know, about around middle of the year.
That's pretty good. I mean, what I tell my clients is in the first month, expect to generate $1 in revenue for every dollar you spend in advertising. Because nobody knows you, it's a brand new listing. There's no rank, there's no review, no nothing. So expect that, $1 for $1. And then in month 2, expect to generate between $2 to $3 in revenue for every dollar you spend. Because by that time, 4 weeks have gone, you're gonna take out some of the keywords that don't pay, then add some good ones, and then focus on the content a little bit more, tweak it. So, and then come month 3, that's when the campaign should be stabilizing, where you generate $4 for every dollar spent. Right. So that way, you know, if this is just for planning purposes. So the wild card in here is these total sales are total sales. It's not just sales generated from the ads. Right. So, when you calculate like that and plan that way, you can never be disappointed because you've already estimated pretty aggressive being like spend aggressively without much expectation. And since you are advertising, you're going to get sales anyway. Plus being the organic ranking in the meantime that you'll rank up, being the wild card. So that will also... add to your sales top line, and then your takeoffs will become much, much more attractive, which ends up being like 10 to 15%, which is what you were talking about 6 to 8 times, right?
Right, correct.
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, this is very useful for those who are listening or about to launch. You know, how do you manage this? So, final question on the marketing budget. Do you have a number that you can tell the listeners that cannot be any less than this to spend in the first month and then going forward?
I just speaking from my own personal experience, I would say you should plan to spend at least a couple thousand. Again, that's from my space, and I don't know if it's different in other industries or different types of products, but I think a couple thousand is pretty realistic. And like you mentioned, you shouldn't expect much on that either. So
right.
I think so much in e-commerce when you're just getting started is the perseverance factor, because it's just going to look ugly in the beginning, right? Your return on ad spend's not going to be good. A lot of times your margins aren't going to be as good. And so you just got to push through that and know that you have a plan to keep going, you know, in the next few months after that.
Yeah, definitely. I will tell you, I tell my clients, expect to spend $5,000 in your first month. Because first of all, you want a diverse keyword pool. Right. And that pool takes a budget. And each one is different bid rate. If you keep it small, to keep the budget small, then, you know, some of them will work, some of them won't. But those that work won't add up too much going forward. So it's best to, you know, go after some short tail, some long tail, and then, and that takes budget. So expect $5,000. In fact, I recently launched a client. We set $5,000, but after a week, I see my PPC person saying, you know, we're going to have to push this up to six. Can I spend $6,000? I said, yeah, go ahead. Because, you know, you are in it now. You can't dial it down because you are ranking and orders are coming in. The idea is to make it, you know, stay. And for that, you need to keep getting the ranking up.
Yeah, well, I would certainly say that anyone should listen to you over me in this, again, because it's my first year getting it going on Amazon. And so part of that was my own trepidation about overspending in the beginning, along with other projects we were running. So I certainly would trust that.
Well, you know, when you do something for a long time, some things you say, you know, okay, you know, it's like, you know, when you start training martial arts, you know, the first thing you do is you strengthen your hands and your knuckles and everything, so that way, you know, it doesn't hurt. So after a while, you know, you get used to it. It doesn't matter. So it's like that, you know, when you see, you know, yeah, you can do it little, you can, but you're just cutting your, then it becomes this drip, drip, drip situation. You have to go where the action is and then evaluate. Yeah.
No, I completely agree in that format. You know, I was speaking from the perspective of someone basically coming in brand new to the space at the time, and being clueless is not quite the right word, but certainly when it comes to things like Amazon spend. Yeah. And so.
Yeah. So many moving parts. But I mean, you did very well. I mean, you did very well. The other thing is, you know, when you did that, when was that?
That would have been about January of last year when we started.
Okay. January. So we're recording this in the December of 2022.
Yeah. So January.
Okay, so you know how things fly in the e-commerce space. That's almost two years. So budgets are going up, bids are going up. So it's understandable. Probably what you spent $2,000 probably today is worth maybe $3,500, $4,000 already. So
yeah.
Okay. So you did your research. You found the product. You decided what the content is going to be, and you set the marketing budget. What comes next?
I would start thinking about ways you can start building infrastructure around your listings at that point, right? And so what I mean by that is starting efforts to reach out to review websites that list products. You know, a lot of them are going to specifically look for Amazon products, look for reporters and writers who cover the space and frequently write about those, try to get in contacts and get on their lists, look for Amazon influencers, people who are posting about Amazon content in stores quite a bit. And then I start trying to, like I said, build that infrastructure where I have a set way of reaching out to those people, being on their radar, getting links back to the product itself.
So this is about collecting reviews ultimately, because you want the rating, product rating, right? So have you ever tried the Vine program?
Yes. Yeah.
So share with us some of your thoughts about that. Would you recommend it? And what do you think about it?
Yeah, I think I would recommend it overall for sure, right? Because to me, reviews are some of the most important things that you can do. You know, we had some products do really well with the Vine program. We had some that didn't do so well. And, you know, I would say, well, I don't think this reviewer knows what they're talking about, right? On some of them. But yeah, I would certainly, I'm glad you mentioned that, include the Vine program as far as building that infrastructure around it for sure.
So there is one little caveat here with the Vine program. you don't make a sale, right? There's zero value. So if your product is a high ticket item, you cannot, unless you want to give away the whole thing. But what will happen is I totally support the Vine program as long as your price point will support it. So when you sign up for the Vine program, the cost is well worth it, and you're going to start to get orders. These orders right. will be coming in, and then they'll all have sub-order total zero. So right. one after the other. And so don't let that surprise you. Those are all free reviews, basically. And then right. the good news is those people will leave a review because that's why they are buying. And then it will say right above your review, Vine buyer or Vine verified or one or the other. So it will be there for sure. But be prepared to give away the whole thing. So that's something that I always say.
I definitely would include that in any type of marketing plans early on, that you should expect to provide a lot of free samples for reviews, whether that's the Vine program or any other items that I just mentioned with review websites. That's something that in my first business, I don't think we did enough of early on. And over time, we adapted and figured it out and were very, very well reviewed. But like there was one article that we had the opportunity to contribute to and we did not. And it just became a thorn in our side because it became so high ranking over time. And so I certainly would advise that anyone, if you're just getting started, you need to have some sort of budgeting in your mind for the amount of product you're willing to give away to things like those. Because like you said, it leads to reviews. And that's one of the most important things.
So the other thing about what I find ironic is in the early days, about 6 months or so ago, you could run ads on Facebook and say, place an order for my product and then I'll reimburse you 100%. Of the sale once you leave a review. Then suddenly Amazon put pressure. Facebook would not accept such ads anymore. So everything that you set up around this for the purposes of giving away your product to collect reviews, it was frowned upon. You couldn't run ads, and Amazon, if they ever caught you doing this, they would remove the reviews. So now what do? They go and do it themselves.
Right.
What's the difference?
I don't know that I would know the difference. I mean, to me, that's they can do that with pretty much anything, right? Because, you know, like Amazon sells dumbbells, for example. But and
Know the people. They just know the people leaving the review. That's all it is. They know the people. So instead of it's anybody and everybody, they know the people and they display it as a Vine review. But I just find some of these things a little bit hypocritical, frankly. So,
yeah, I mean, I think obviously in the name of protecting their own brand and protecting their own business, they're just going to have to do those, right? You know, we certainly, I have tried that early on, actually. I have tried driving Facebook ads to Amazon listings to see if that helped in getting new customers. My previous business, we were our own D2C business first and had a pretty good size email list. So when we started selling on Amazon, we actually would run targeted sales to our email list at our Amazon page to try to even get more reviews on our Amazon page and rank it up faster. So I do think that your review strategy is probably one of the most important things that you can start establishing next step you set up.
Yeah. I mean, reviews are key to conversion rates. So people won't buy if they don't see the reviews. So, okay. So we got the product, we got the marketing, we're not spending the advertising dollars and we're getting reviews. So now what are you tracking as this whole thing is happening? What are some numbers you are tracking?
Obviously, you'd be looking at the sales numbers, right? The average cost of a sale and the return on ad spend. I think those are really important. And then obviously your own profitability, right? So those are things that, I mean, anybody should be tracking. The way that I would be thinking about it next is, as you had these orders coming in, one is you need to be just providing impeccable service to the customers, right? That's how you build a brand, and a way that a company that people want to come back to is replying really fast, you know, creating an experience that makes them want to review the product really well. So, and also using those interactions to then potentially adjust and tweak your listings on Amazon. So I pretty frequently, based on the customer service questions that we start getting early on in the life of a product, we'll start adding that information to a product listing. So those questions are actually answered ahead of time or overcome potential impediments to sales.
So share with us how, because I'm sure people have seen, or you go to, you have reviews. You, first of all, it used to be just reviews. Now you have reviews and ratings. You may have more ratings than reviews because not everybody wants to write stuff. But then you also have questions and answers. So how can somebody who's never done this before create questions and answers themselves?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know that, I mean, if you're asking, did I create any on our own listing to display those? We haven't done anything like that. Obviously, you could look at your competitors, right? So you could see what the questions and answers are on those and start incorporating some of those into your descriptions and your bullet points as well. You know, very early on, your question was about what types of numbers are you tracking. You're not going to have a ton of data early on, right, in the life of a business. And so you have to kind of tie things together and make good decisions based on the very limited inputs that you're seeing, right? So if I was relating it to your question here about the questions and answers, yeah, I do recommend, and I have done this, scanning the questions and answers of competitors, right? And maybe you're not sure if that's an important piece of information, but I would say like the second or first or second time you also get that same question about your product or in a post-purchase, that should be a pretty good indicator. That's like a really important piece of data that I would figure out a way to put front and center, whether it's in your A+ content or your bullet points or anything else like that.
Yeah, because those questions that appear and then the answers under them, they are all customer driven. So Amazon right. sends out emails soliciting the answers to the questions to people who have bought the item. So it would be a good idea to be able to structure those questions so that Amazon can simply go out and then ask people to answer those questions if they made a purchase already of that product.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
So as far as tracking, so how about conversion rates and click-through rates and things like that? Do you watch those?
Yeah, I do somewhat. And, you know, that for me, at least in this first year, it's just helped me think about what types of products would I want to prioritize over others or potentially cut, you know, in favor of maybe bringing in a new product. You know, again, or is there something missing from the product description, right? So, you know, if I notice that a particular product is not converting as well as others, you know, I'll try to do a side-by-side comparison of what is this one potentially lacking compared to this other one, or what is this one lacking compared to some of the competitors, for example. So I do use those types of numbers to try to fix things like that.
So tell us what a good conversion rate to you is. So what do you expect to see on your listing as the conversion rate?
Yeah, for me at least, it's been really different because, like I mentioned, you know, with dumbbells, for example, we've had a lot of success with good sales, which obviously means a higher conversion rate, and some other items, you know, not as much. On dumbbells, you know, I think we get maybe around a 5 or 6% conversion rate. But then, you know, I do have some products that I will keep selling just because I think it's important as part of the overall niche and business that we're in, you know, that may have like a, you know, a 1% or less conversion rate. So it can certainly be all over the map.
So by conversion, what is the calculation for conversion? Because on a website, conversion is how many people hit the website and how many people ended up buying. So on Amazon, it's a different calculation. So how are you measuring the conversion yourself on your Amazon listings?
For me, there's a couple ways, actually. One is looking at the business reports in Amazon to see what they're saying about the traffic and conversion. And also, I mentioned the infrastructure with the review websites and things like that, where I do have access to their data sometimes about, you know, how much click-through are they getting on the articles or content they create about us. And what did they potentially show in sales if they're running affiliate links too?
Okay. All right. Yeah. I mean, so for the listener's benefit, conversion rate means that out of the number of people that landed on your product detail page, how many of them ended up buying? So Amazon used to measure that by dividing the number of units purchased by number of sessions on the page. So what that meant was, let's say that I'm an Amazon shopper. I landed on your page. That's one session. And then I buy three pieces right there. I see, oh, it's a good deal. Plus you happen to be offering a promotion if you buy more than two pieces. So I buy three pieces. Amazon would count that as 300% conversion. That calculation recently changed. And they fixed it because this was the wrong way to show it. So some of those who are used to reviewing the business reports will know that there was a huge drop in conversion rates. So people suddenly thought, what's happening? Why suddenly our conversions up? Because what Amazon did, they changed the calculation of it. And now one order counts as one. Even if it has multiple pieces in it, every order would be one divided by the number of visits. So since that is the conversion rate, what you are doing is you're saying, okay, how many orders did I receive? And how many people came to my product page? I find the numbers that you've given, I think there is a lot of room for growth because industry average for conversion rate is 12% across the board. Of course, some categories are much less, depending on if it's a high ticket item, it's less. But either way, so what I always recommend is shoot for at least the industry average. And then if you're not getting that, that means there's room for growth in your content. Something is happening and you can figure out by running one of the new features Amazon has called experiments. So have you tried experiments?
Yeah, I have tried those a little bit for all the reasons you just mentioned, which is looking at some of the conversion rates and not being too happy with them. So I have tried some. I wouldn't say that personally, like I had a lot of success with them. Obviously, if I knew why that was, I would have solved it. But, you know, I tried things like different product images, you know, display it in a different way or, you know, and obviously, like I said, tweaking it over time. Given that this is, you know, my first time really trying to kind of build it from scratch, I've been probably unaware about one, what should I be shooting for, you know, versus again, the infancy of the listing, so to speak, relative to others and the smaller amount of reviews. Is that something I'm just going to have to earn over time for that better conversion rate? You know, with resistance bands, for example, you're going up against 20 other sellers that have thousands of reviews, right? Compared to like the 20 or 30 that the product might have at the same time.
Yeah. So going back to your first action in selecting the product, one of the things that I always recommend is when you are selecting your product or your niche, look at the competition and look at how many reviews they have. If you are getting into a space where your nearest competition is hundreds and hundreds of reviews, it's going to be very hard for you to go up against them.
Right.
I mean, it can be done, but it's going to be quite a bit of a hike. But if you have like 30, 50, 100 reviews, that's a much easier space to penetrate, because you can rank up. You know, you get the Vine program, you get this, you get that. Plus, as you do your advertising, some of those orders will generate reviews for you. But if you have these huge number of reviews, it's much harder. So it really is, at the end of the day, part of that research activity that you have.
Okay, yeah, and so definitely going forward, that's something, like I mentioned, that I would be a lot more cognizant of. What I would consider right now for our brain is we have what I would consider a lot of just pretty much baseline fitness products. It says, like, if we're going to be a fitness company, these are items that we have to have, right? And to your point, it is extremely competitive and tough, for sure.
Yeah. So, okay, so tracking the numbers. So you're doing your advertising is running. So how long do you give your operation to say, okay, this is in launch mode, so everything is up in the air, numbers don't mean anything, we're just trying to see what's working? And then at what point do you say, okay, now we are getting into maintenance mode to basically manage growth? How long is it before you say, okay, that's it, now let's go into maintenance?
I don't know that I would have a set time for me personally of when that would be. It's, you know, it's going to kind of be a number of factors just based on the amount of time that I've been doing this. I think a lot of it would just depend on, is inventory in a steady state, for example. And because to me, I've always experienced businesses that have outages on inventory, right? That's always what I've struggled with in the previous business, you know, because we were growing so fast and we were a new business. And so I've always felt like it was kind of hard to trust a lot of the numbers that I was seeing for those reasons. So I think for me, at least, if I had 6 months of kind of steady state of products not running out, ads consistently running and tweaking, I would consider that a good amount of time.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I people say, you know, how quickly can we launch? No. There is no rushing of a launch. What you do is you launch one parent at a time. And when you launch that parent, it will take you the exact number of months, 6 months, before you can say, okay, this operation is now stable. We are now educated about what we can expect. We know we have a strategy going forward to push it. Then at that point, you can start working on another listing. But it does take 6 months. So I always say, first product, 6 months, and then work on launching another parent per quarter. So one parent per quarter is a good, you know, reference point to say, this is what you can expect and this is what you need to do. So, okay. So as far as one thing we haven't discussed, and you mentioned a couple of times, your demand planning, right? Because if you run out of inventory, that's sudden death. No more ranking, no more nothing, everything stops. So how do you prepare for that? What are you watching in order to make sure that you have enough inventory at Amazon?
So my first business, we really struggled with this for quite some time. You know, we'd go months at a time without some of our best SKUs. I finally settled on a piece of software that I use that is importing all the orders and the velocity of that. And then you can provide inputs to it. You know, how long is production going to take? How many days of stock do you want to have? That type of thing. And I've pretty much started using that as a baseline for ordering. And that's the way that I handle it now.
And which software is that?
It's called Inventory Planner.
Inventory Planner. Okay. And it was close enough to...
Yeah, I've found it to be pretty close over time.
Yeah. Because one of the things that I noticed with Amazon operation, things can scale overnight. Yeah. So how do you plan for those things? And especially if it's for the shopping season, and, you know, I remember when I was a seller, every Thanksgiving, like, there's always something going on. You know, you either travel long distance or you have everybody over, you know, eating, drinking, whatever. And then I will sit in front of the computer at night. Yeah. And then I would see the orders. And every year it was the same. Orders would triple. Overnight, they would triple, and then they would keep going up. So how do you plan for that? And of course, you never know what's going to happen. So,
I mean, that's tough to do, because in a lot of ways, you kind of feels like you're ordering based on faith, right? Because even if you triple the last year, I think for a lot of people, you're like, well, am I going to triple again this year? I don't know. For something like that, again, in my first year of business, it wasn't so much the planning that I needed to do, because just the reality is I didn't think it was just going to be a huge, you know, Black Friday type situation. I will say the metric that I have seen since I've been in business is what I would consider a good Black Friday is basically doing about a month's worth of orders, you know, over that specific holiday, for example, right? So in past years, that's what we did. We did do that this year, which is great that, you know, in our first year, we've kind of seen that same metric. So basically that just tells me that next year, starting in June and July, I'm going to have to start ordering enough from suppliers to potentially meet that demand. And that's how I would plan for it.
Yeah. Okay. So tell us, what is next for Living Fit? What are you looking? Are you going to again build this up and then sell it, or? What is in the future of Living Fit?
We have some new products coming out soon. So everything that we just discussed about evaluating products, there are some new ones that we're going to have coming out in the fitness space. I think you mentioned in the beginning that we do have workouts and digital items. So we're going to continue to develop those and try to make that into a world-class experience. You know, I've listened to some of those past episodes where people talk about the QR codes on the boxes and things like that. And so, you know, that's going to be a big focus as we perfect that experience, having QR codes where people can go to get free workouts with the equipment that they purchase. Obviously, the idea there is that eventually there'll be workouts that they do purchase from us, but there'll be an intro membership. So the most important things right now are accommodating the growth that we're having and making plans for inventory ordering, as well as the digital setup for us.
That's great. I mean, I'm glad you mentioned it. I had a gentleman, his name is Todd Snively. So his episode is full of very cool tips he shared. And he simply just gave away all the tricks that he uses himself. And part of it is the QR code. So you have a package insert, and inside on that package insert, you have a QR code that is no strings attached. Here, claim your free whatever. And of course, when they scan the QR code, where are they going? They're going to your website. Right. It's purpose built. It's a landing page. And that's where you can capture their information and build some kind of brand loyalty. And that's the tip that he shared. And we use that. I mean, we've been using package inserts, but the QR code, frankly, was out of that episode that I started using with every client of mine. And right. Now I have every client has a QR code to claim this, and a QR code to get your, warranty or whatever the case may be. So. It's a great tip. So this was great. I mean, hearing directly from someone who's doing it on a day-to-day basis and in the early stages, it's very valuable, because it kind of tells anybody who's looking to get into this how to do it. And then you gave the step-by-step approach to how to do this. So let's learn a little bit about you now. Enough of the business talk. So tell us, where did you grow up? Take us back to your beginnings, so to speak.
Grew up in San Antonio, Texas, and lived there through the end of high school. I moved to Austin, Texas to go to college. I got here in about 2004 and pretty much immediately fell in love with it. And so I've been in Austin since 2004.
Oh, so were you always an entrepreneurial person growing up as a kid?
You know, I think so, actually. Like if you could ask me at the earliest ages of when I was going to have to start getting jobs and things like that, you know, my answer would have been, I want to work on something that I create out of my brain. Right. And so, you know, if there is such a thing, I certainly think that's true. Now, you know, the funny story would be that, you know, like my sister and I used to walk around the neighborhood and try to sell like drawings to neighbors or like go to door to door and, you know, try to sell different things. So I think there was some interest in business and from the beginning. But certainly as I started getting older in the teenage years and thinking about having to get jobs, I would have never had an answer like, you know, I want to be a lawyer or a doctor or anything like that. It would always been that, you know, I want to exist in some type of infrastructure where I can work on my own ideas.
So I have two questions for you. Between you and your sister going door to door selling drawings, who was doing the drawings, you or your sister?
It was a joint effort. Yeah, we were both having to put in the effort. We didn't have we didn't have equal division of duties. One was the drawer and one was the salesperson. I think we were both doing it.
You were both doing it. And whose idea was it to go around selling them?
I'm going to take credit for it. I can't confirm now because it's probably been close to 30 years, but I'm going to say that it was probably my idea. And that's just based off of she's not started her own business. And so I think I'm going to, wow. It was me.
Yeah, it had to be you. So how did your parents take this when you came up with the idea and you're doing this? Did they support it?
You're talking about the drawings or just the business in general?
Going around making money, you know, selling drawings.
Oh, I think they probably just thought it was fine. You know, in starting the business, it was interesting. I wouldn't say they weren't supportive. They weren't super supportive. My folks are just kind of realistic. And so my dad would say something like, you know, like, well, you know, 90%+ of businesses fail in their first year. and so I do think that that's how I'm a lot different than my parents is I have a lot more appetite to try things, you know, whether that's risk or something else. But yeah, I think the drawings were more fine with in starting an e-commerce business.
Well, I mean, that's when you are forming your whole, you know, approach to life and risk-taking. And obviously this is something that you are creating and then going around making money. And I didn't hear your parents were against it. They didn't necessarily say no, but they didn't embrace it either. It's like, you know, they let you be and then you found your way to pursuing it, right? Is that the way it worked out?
Yeah, that's definitely true. And in some ways that might've been the absolute best way they could be, you know, like, in a lot of ways, I had wished at times that they said, oh, you're going to be a lawyer or you're going to be a doctor or something like that. Because I think everyone has a certain age in life where they're like, what am I going to do with my life? I need some direction. They always kind of just said, do what makes you happy. And so in a way, that's some of the best advice that they could give because it's, you know, what I ended up doing.
So this is obviously right at the beginning, and then you kind of, you know, evolve through life and then graduate school and then your first job, you were working somewhere or did you just start up right from the get-go, your business?
So my first job out of college was financial planning. And I do think that was a very important part of the formation of who I am, because one, this was in 2007 that I graduated college. So it was right before the great financial crisis. So, you know, not the best time to be in finance and try to convince people to let you invest your money. Two is it's just such a hard job. You're making 100 phone calls a day, you know, cold calling people. You're going in on Saturday mornings to cold call people. And you take a lot of rejection and it takes a lot of perseverance. And I do think those are really important traits that I've formed in that industry that are particularly helpful in starting and running a business.
Yeah. So, and then, so when was it that you started thinking, I better start my own business? You know, I don't want to do this, work for somebody else. When did that start to form as I thought, Senor?
So with the original business that we started with my co-founders, while I was doing financial planning, we would hold weekly meetings for about a year or two, just kicking around business ideas. So, you know, this is when we were 24, 25 years old, and all three of us knew we wanted to be doing our own things, not having our own jobs. And we literally just would have conversations about what about this business idea? Or what about that business idea? During that time, that's when I ended up moving to BigCommerce, which you mentioned before, and I was selling e-commerce software. And so that became part of the discussions that we were having. And again, we were about 24, 25 at this time. And that's eventually what led to starting the original business and pretty much the career that I'm in right now.
So so it was, for you, it was inevitable, right? It was just waiting in the wings. It was going to happen, and then you just simply went for it in the end.
Yeah, I think so in a way. I mean, I think working at BigCommerce was very fortuitous in that it exposed me to e-commerce and learning a lot about what it would take to form the baselines of an online business. And so in some regard, that's probably luck, but I do think that the want was always there. I might not have known how I was going to get there or what I was going to do. And that's where working at BigCommerce helped make that a lot more clear.
Yeah. So there is a long time ago, I was listening to a podcast about leadership, and these two guys are talking to each other. And one of them said, so you have all these kids that are working summer jobs. Their entire purpose is make a few bucks so that they can buy the stuff that they want to buy. That's what they are getting these summer jobs for. They couldn't care less about the job itself. All they want is just make a few bucks. So how do you motivate people like that? And the guy said, sure, of course. It's very hard because they don't really care other than the money. So, but if you actually pull them aside and say, look, you are here to make a few bucks. The work that you're doing is important work, but really anybody else can do it. However, there is something unique about it, because by being here throughout the day, every day, you are seeing a business in action. You are seeing how the products are being purchased, how they are being warehoused, how they are being put on the shelves, merchandising, cash registers. So this is your opportunity to learn how a business operates. So pay some attention and learn something that you can use down the road. That's how you motivate them. So when you were just telling me the story, you know, working in BigCommerce. So all along, in the back of your mind, you're just learning the business, right? So you know you want to start it one day, and then you were learning the business. So this was in the end the catalyst to you starting, and then frankly avoiding some of the learning curve because you already knew operating a technology company in e-commerce space what it means.
Yeah, absolutely. Whether it's the actual process of e-commerce business and what you need to do that, or just a business in general, you know, building out channel sales, building out direct-to-consumer sales, building out B2B sales, those were all things that I observed were going on around me while I was there.
Yeah, this is great. So Jay, tell us, how can people reach you, share with us your contact information?
I can be found on LinkedIn as Jay Perkins. My email, I guess if that's helpful, is fine. It's jay@living.fit. And then on Instagram, we're living.fit as well.
Great. Thank you. This is very useful for anybody who wants to do it. They can hear your personal experience. So anybody who's gone through the same kind of things but doing something else today, you're telling them, look, you know, it's in your blood. Get it going as soon as possible, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's for a lot of people, myself being in that camp, it's the realization of like who you are as a person, I think, you know, and so it's not easy, but it is certainly one of the most fulfilling things. And, you know, I've had friends quit their jobs as lawyers to become like writers in LA. And whenever I hear about someone doing something like that, I feel so much joy for them because I know the fulfillment they'll feel from doing what, you know, they really feel called to do.
Yeah. Yeah. So true. Okay. And thank you for being here, Jay. Thank you.
Yep. Thanks for having me.
And this brings us to the end of another episode, and I'll see you on the next one.
Thank you for tuning in to today's episode. Be sure and subscribe, rate, and review our show. And be sure and share an episode with a friend. And thank you so much for being with us today. We'll see you next week here on Amazon Legends.